Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller.
That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Us, I like you, like it or not. That's when it got wheels off.
Christopher Harris, Chris to his loyal listeners, will not stay in his lane. This is a guy who for years worked for ESPN as a writer and personality, and when he went solo was brave enough to start his own podcast about fantasy football, and that has proven to be the little podcast that could. He has hundreds of thousands of listeners who depend on him for their fantasy football information. But he's much more than that. He writes novels. For the last decade, he's been consistently writing novels that refuse to be pigeonholed. His subject matter is widely varied, but his writing is consistent. He's a really smart, funny, thoughtful, quick-witted guy. He has an analytical mind, but he's also got one of those wildly creative personalities that jumps around. He's fun to listen to if you like fantasy football, and he's great to read. And it turns out he's an excellent guest for a conversation such as the one we had in the living room of his apartment in Los Angeles, though listeners to his podcast will be disappointed to find out that that is not aboard a yacht. It's actually many floors up in a high rise in downtown Los Angeles. But Chris Harris is a good dude. He's everything you'd hope for. He's funny. He's smart. He's present. He thinks a lot about what he's doing. And he works really hard. And if you've listened to me in these conversations that comprise now over a half a year's worth of this show, Wheels Off, you know that I value work ethic perhaps above all else. The one thing that I like even more than that is authenticity. And not in the stupid, like, every country singer has to grow up on a farm sense, but just somebody that really is trying to give you something honest every time they create something. And I think Chris Harris does that. And I'm so glad I got to speak to him. For Wheels Off, please welcome Christopher Harris. Chris Harris, welcome to Wheels Off.
Thank you.
Thanks for being my guest. We're here today in your, what we affectionately, your listeners of your podcast called The Yacht, but we're here in your apartment in Los Angeles.
And are you really going to ruin this? You're going to ruin the myth that I actually live aboard a yacht?
We're here in your actual yacht right now in downtown Los Angeles. And it's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me on. It's really, really flattering.
What creative project are you working on right now, and how is it inspiring you?
So I'm working on a new novel. It'll be, if I finish, it'll be my fifth finished book that I hope will be a fifth published book. It's about a 30-year-old man who quits the internet, who moves to a resort town to become a bartender, and meets a couple of people who've also given up the capitalist life in some way and have moved to do service industry jobs. Did you ever read Generation X? Douglas Copeland?
I don't think I did.
So it's sort of a... I really liked that book. Uh-huh. When I was a kid, I really liked that book. And so it's kind of a conscious update in a way. That book was about three people who quit capitalism and go live in Palm Springs.
Yeah.
And I have them going to Tahoe. So big difference. So it's not, you know, I mean, I'm very consciously using the same kind of dynamic, but with Generation X, whenever that was, 1989 or something, there was no internet.
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
Did you go back and reread Generation X to sort of feel the structure of it?
I did. And mostly I want to make sure that I'm respecting another really good author's work and not just rewriting it. You know, I wrote this novel called Tulsa, which is my most recent one that came out, and I reread The Road, Cormac McCarthy, in order to, like, I love that book, but also I wanted to make sure I didn't rewrite The Road, because that book already exists, that's pretty good.
Yeah. I could see similarities in those.
And in fact, in Tulsa, I have somebody reading out loud from The Road, just so that everybody could go, yes, I'm aware.
Yeah.
I'm aware this book exists. I'm aware. And yeah, and so for this new one, I'm aware Generation X exists. I'm, you know, but it is sort of the millennial version, I guess, in a way. But I'm trying to kind of, it's the same but different in a way that I hope Tulsa is also the same but different.
Yeah, it's funny how often that comes up. But, and I think that there must be so much truth to it. Like the way we learn to do something is by mimicking the thing that we love,
yeah,
right? And I mean, so often, I interviewed Michael Chabon the other day, and he was talking about his first things he ever did were basically Sherlock Holmes fan fiction. So it's funny how, I mean, I think of the first songs I wrote, and they were kind of like the musical version of fan fiction to Bowie or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's so funny. And the different novels that you write tend to be very different. You know, you're in the world of indie rock, you're in the world of post-apocalypse, you're in the, you know, and it's kind of all over the place. Do you think that there's a single question that kind of runs between them that you're sort of trying to answer? Like something you're grappling with yourself as an author, as you create these different worlds, disparate worlds?
That's really for the biographers to decide. Yeah, so, I mean, there's one about an NFL player who's too small to play but wants to anyway. There's one about a guy who's been traumatized at war and comes back to Austin and becomes a private detective, like a gumshoe, but isn't very good at it. I feel like maybe the project is connection, loneliness. For sure, that's what's on my mind with this one, what the internet does to us, this thing that's supposed to connect us that somehow weirdly winds up fragmenting us more. But I wouldn't say that I sit down every time I'm going to write a book and say, golly, I wonder how I can express my loneliness differently this time.
Yeah, of course.
It just seems to be maybe the thing that comes out. And I mean, I know your music pretty well, and that's something that comes out for you a lot too.
Yeah, but I never know what the songs are about till later, right? Yeah. I wonder if, and do you think that if you sit down and you're calculating, how am I going to, you know, explicate loneliness for my reader? You know what I mean? Like it's something that you have to make be unconscious as you're writing, right?
Yeah, I'm certainly not thinking that at all. I'm certainly, and then the double question on top of that becomes, who are you in these books? Are you this Scott from War on Sound? Are you the unnamed narrator from Tulsa? Are you the football player from... And I feel like when I'm writing them, I'm almost never that person. It's always... I'm not very interesting, right? And yet you're only putting in what you know. And writers are pretty solitary people anyway, and I probably in some way everybody's somewhat solitary without realizing how common that is. And so the concerns of these characters who don't feel like they're actually me kind of wind up being my concerns.
Yeah, isn't that... I'll probably want to ask you at some point about the feelings of inadequacy or fear or the sort of internally generated obstacles. That's something I really am kind of obsessed with, how artists deal with that. But I wonder, just even that question of how autobiographical is this? Who are you in this? That question of when the reader looks at it and then contemplates how much of you is in it, do you ever feel paralyzed by that? Is that something that is a hang-up for you?
Not really.
You seem to have been very prolific. I don't see you getting too hung up.
Yeah, I have a lot of free time in the winters. As you know, my day job is covering the NFL. So, in the winters, I have a lot of free time. So I just write. I don't feel like I get worried about whether people are going to interpret that I'm a character or not a character. I rarely set out and go. So the answer is I'm Scott from War on Sound. Uh-huh. Like if there's ever been a dude who's been me as I'm not a musician, right? And yeah. He's, I guess, pretty talented in the world of that book. But his outlook, his feelings about himself, that pretty blatantly, people who know my backstory of my life, my family read that and my parents recognized his parents as them. Like that is as close as I'll ever get. I don't think I would want to do it again. And that I probably had some anxiety over. I think the rest of it, if you know, clearly the main character in Slopback Rhapsody, not me.
Yeah.
Clearly the main character in Tulsa, not me. But so I don't worry if I put in a feeling or something that I've expressed to somebody or some detail from my life that's really one piece that's like from my life, but the rest isn't. I don't get too worried about that.
So you mentioned that your day job is covering the NFL and thinking of it in terms of the fantasy football angle. But when you were growing up, you didn't think of becoming a fantasy football expert. You dreamt of becoming a novelist, I would guess, first,
I sure
right?
Did, yeah.
Did you have like an epiphany moment? I mean, I know you studied for a lot of years, but at the very beginning of it, like how old were you when you realized you wanted to do this? And what do you remember about that moment?
This is crazy that we're doing this today because I'm writing this new novel. Uh-huh. And I have a character. So the new novel is a first person present tense. The guy goes to Tahoe and he decides to write what it's like to leave the internet. And so he is telling the story, like, quote unquote, in real time. And I'm just today, this morning, before we started talking, writing about his epiphany moments of becoming a fiction writer. So they're very fresh in my mind.
That's crazy.
I mean, I was a reader from really young. And my mom worked for like a regional book chain that no longer exists because I don't think there are regional book chains anymore. And would bring, she brought home tons of books, but also we would get paperback proof copies of forthcoming novels delivered almost every day to the house because publishers at the time would send them, there was only print books, that was all there was in the world, and they would send them to try to convince the buyers to stock the book. So we had so many books, and I read so much stuff, and man, there was something about that. There was something about the reading that made me want to do it. The first thing I remember writing, and this is in the new novel, so I'm scooping myself. I have a younger sister by 2 years. I must have been 12, 13 or something. I wrote what would now be called a podcast series of, it was called Exiles from the Planet Ruminoff. I believe it was basically Battlestar Galactica, but I just decided to. So it was like somebody's planet was destroyed, and there was like a ragtag group of people who got away, and they were out there searching for a new home. But I, you know, I'd stolen it obviously, but didn't realize. There's a long history of thievery in my.
Emulation, inspiration.
Yeah, emulation. And I would read it out loud to my sister and her friends.
That's so cool.
And so, yeah, I was a podcaster even back then. And I think I never got to the end because the school year started again, but I'm sure I wrote a ton of it. I'm sure I did. I'm sure there were, I mean, dozens of pages anyway.
How old do you think you were?
I think probably 12.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, from, I just liked the way I felt when I did it. But
it's funny that you did it as kind of a gift for your sister. I mean, there was this probably a selfishness to it because it was so much fun and you were driven to do it. But I always think of art in terms of being a gift. Do you feel like it was something that she thought was super cool and she loved it? And for you, was it cool to be able to like kind of give her this thrill?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I think I did it. And then I, like for myself, and then I probably said, hey, I did this thing, and was surprised that she wanted me to hear it out loud.
Yeah.
And then she really liked it. So then I was like, I'll do more. And then I remember she and a friend of hers saying, hey, have you done more? Have you done more? And I'd be like, oh, let me go do some more. So it was, she was my first patron.
Yeah.
It sort of was that thing of positive feedback loop. Probably leading to good feelings.
I wonder about that too, just because the audience aspect of what we do, and so many writers that I know specifically tend to be very phobic about interacting with their audience or reading what people say about it. Or, I mean, you, by virtue of your other job, you have so much interaction with your audience, and it's such a large audience and vocal, and like I just wonder to what extent. I mean, clearly you're not phobic about input, and I get the feeling even with your novels that you like to hear from people, and you like, when you're writing, is it something you're super aware of? Like,
I don't think when I'm writing, I'm thinking about it at all. I know I'm not.
That's great.
Yeah, I'm not thinking about it at all. But, so Tulsa, this most recent one, like I didn't expect it did really well. Like I think I've sold more copies of that book in 6 months than I've sold of all my other books put together over their whole lives, some of which are like 8 or 9 years.
Yeah.
And that's because there's this thing called the apocalypse that's really popular. that I've just, you know, got, people were like, oh, let's read about the apocalypse. And Tulsa has a little bit of, it's a little bit of a bait and switch in mm-hmm. that it's about the apocalypse, but in the end you finish it and you're like, was it about this guy? What, you know? And so I've gotten more, there were probably 4 months or so right after it came out where every single day I'd get at least an email, a tweet, something about the book. Somebody saying they're in the middle of it and really liking it. Somebody saying they were confused by something. Somebody who is more of a fan of my football work, but sort of wanted to just dive in and felt like, am I missing something? And then inevitably the way the book ends is a particular ending that I don't want to say, but it isn't all completely resolved.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
And so a lot of am I missing something, or why did you do this? Or I like that you did this, but could you explain it in a way that I've never had for fiction before?
Oh, wow.
Never.
But you don't explain it to them, right? You tell them that if they want to follow the clues, they can make up their own mind. I'm assuming.
Yeah. I certainly don't. It depends on how the person asks, to be honest.
Okay.
If the person asks super sweetly and they say, you know, what was your intent? And it really means a lot to me and I really liked it and all that stuff. I might kind of say, well, think about what comes second to last. Think about what comes last. That should be some level of a breadcrumbs about what happens, and then also why it ends that way, that it's much more about this guy and him in the worst possible circumstances actually becoming himself much more than he ever was when the power was on.
Yeah.
And then the people who are more like, screw you, you know, this really hurt, you know, this sucks that you didn't tell me what happened. Is there a sequel coming? Most of those people I go, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it makes sense that you would write a book about wanting to get away from the internet after all of it. Now, you did a lot of schooling. I mean, mm-hmm. you did UMass, master's at UMass MFA.
MFA, yeah.
Is that the same thing as a master? I don't understand school.
Yeah.
It was a master of fine arts.
Yes.
At UMass.
They call it a terminal degree.
Oh, geez.
For a reason.
Yeah. Do you feel like that was crucial to your abilities? I mean, is it something you really look back on as being a great experience and it helped you a lot?
It did help. I mean, I went to business school at University of Texas right out of, so I went to undergrad, had 1 year out, then went to University of Texas for business school. I was the youngest in the program. There weren't a lot of straight through type people in business school at the time. And then I went and worked for a while, and then 30-ish is when I went back to MFA at UMass. And that was an experience of now I'm older than 75% of the people. And honestly, if I had done it vice versa, if I'd done the MFA right away, I don't think I'd have gotten anything out of it. I needed to grow up. And for me, an MFA program was time to write.
Yeah.
And that's a 3-year program, not a 2-year program.
So you really used it.
And I think if I'd been 23, I just would have goofed off, because I kind of goofed off in business school. I mean, it wasn't that hard. And so, I remember very clearly, you've a creative writing guy, so you've done workshops where...
A little bit.
Yeah.
But I dropped out really quickly at college and then regretted it ever since.
But like, the workshop experience is, for people who don't know, you bring in a story, a paper copy for everybody. It's a once a week class, right? So they go away, they come back the next week, and they presumably have read it and marked it up, and they eviscerate you. You know, they basically say what's good, what's bad. It's a very... People who've gone through workshops and MFA programs, some hate it and just hate it, period. And some recognize the utility but never want to do it again. And I think that I'm sort of more in the second camp. But my experience of workshops was always they'd do a schedule at the beginning of the semester, and... you'd sign up for September 23rd or whatever, and then that guy over there signed up for October 5th, and that guy over there signed up for October 12th. But every workshop I ever did, we'd get to the person on October 12th, and they'd be like, oh, I don't really have anything to show. I don't really have anything.
What?
And I'd be like, well, I've got something. I'm writing. So I'd get to go like 3 times in a semester.
Nice.
Because I was there to write, you know, and those guys... and gals tended to be there to do other things or put off life or whatever. So I think it was useful in that I just got so many more pages on my odometer.
Yeah.
And probably not that great, you know, but I used the dime.
You have such a different probably setup in terms of schedule than most people, in that you are working on writing your fiction starting, I'm guessing, January.
Right.
And you go probably up until late summer. And then, how weird is that to step away from it? Is it in the back of your brain throughout the football season while you're doing all the other stuff, or do you really completely step away from it?
So Tulsa, I actually had to work on during the 2017 season. The publisher said, "All right, here's some edits, here's some ideas, here's some thoughts. I'm not clear on what this means, that kind of stuff." So that's been the only book since I've left. I was at ESPN for 8 years, also leading a double life, writing fiction, et cetera. But that's the first season where I actually had to work on both. And I don't recommend it, because the football season for me, I'm doing 5 podcasts a week. Mm-hmm. It's quite all consuming. And I prefer, you know, given that that's how I can afford a yacht.
Yeah.
I like it. It's cool to have like a dichotomy. There's this thing that expresses deeper truths that as I understand them, and then this other thing that's...
Wait, deeper than the NFL?
It's hard to believe.
Yeah.
And then this other thing that the NFL and kind of the communion that we have over the NFL, yeah. I don't care that it's the... I like football fine. I much more care about the communion that we have over it.
Yeah, it's an excuse.
It's an excuse to stay in touch with friends. It's an excuse to rag on our family. Mm-hmm. My show, my podcast is a lot of football, but it's also a lot of meta commentary on what an idiot I am and idiot the guests are and whatever. Like, I never would have believed. I mean, you've heard the songs on my show.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. So for the listeners, fans will write in and they'll make these mixtapes for Chris about things that typically they'll use, like funny, you know, the possum or whatever, right. just stupid stuff that we've said on the show. That come up on the show.
Right. So it is a wondrous audience. I'm like seriously moved to tears sometimes thinking about that audience, and that's not an exaggeration.
Yeah.
I've found this crazy group of sensitive people who are just into the way we talk about, and I honestly don't think the football matters. We all care. We're all trying to win our fantasy leagues and have our NFL teams win and blah. But honestly, I think at base, it's that communion.
What we talk about when we talk about love or whatever. It's a thing that we get. Well, it's, I told you beforehand that the reason I do it anymore is because it's a way that my son and I can have just a thing that connects us. And some of my bandmates, originally I started doing it because you're in the back of a van. You're like, I don't want to talk about the next gig or how crappy the last gig was. Let's talk about whatever.
Odell Beckham getting traded.
Ricky Williams in the day.
Yeah, Ricky Williams. But so anyway, the one time that I had to really do fiction at the same time, I don't know. Time-wise, it was brutal, obviously. Yeah. But honestly, there's like a piece of me that does get turned off a little bit in the during the season where I'm really more focused on the communal thing with these people. I've gotten so addicted to this audience.
Yeah.
And it's a weird feeling, man. It's strange, but I love having that contact with them. And then by December, I'm so ready to not have it for a little while. It's like, it's this big megaphone that I feel like is, I mean, you would understand this is more than I would. So I'm on a lesser level. It's this big megaphone that, you know, Twitter and social media in general, but also just emails. I get so many emails from people who like the show and who have questions about who they should start and all this stuff, that I really love it. I love that I found, and these people have found me, that there's connection, and then I'm ready for it to be gone, and I'm ready to go away and crawl into a hole and write a book or do something else and be much more private.
That's funny. So these conversations I have are about creativity. And it's obvious, you know, with the five novels you've already released and what you're working on now. That's an obvious subject to talk about on a show like this. But I do think, even though what you do with the Harris football thing, I recently interviewed Brian Anderson, who's a sportscaster.
Mm-hmm.
And
I know him.
Yeah. Great guy. Yeah. And the things he had to say blew my mind about just the work you put into it. And I guess why I'm saying this is, part of what you do, I feel like, is you're contextualizing sort of random information and bits and pieces, and you're taking it and you're building a narrative for people. Mm. You're finding a way for people to make sense out of it. So I do think there is something really creative about what you do with a Harris Football podcast. And but would it make sense, right? Because the off season, you're fucking writing novels. So why wouldn't you be doing something that's inherently creative? I mean, do you when you're gearing up to record a podcast, when you're getting ready, are you thinking a lot? Are you thinking like a writer, do you think? Do you ever, clearly you're going to write stuff down.
Yeah.
But do you script out? Does it feel creative?
It feels like a freight train that I'm trying to keep one hand on, that I'm really like barely managing every day. Honestly, that's what it feels like more than anything. But yes, I was telling you before, the reason it takes 5 hours to make one of these football shows is, you know, it only takes about an hour to record it. It's all this prep and figuring out, okay, what's the best way to say this? That would be funny. This kind of dots back to something I've said previously. In some way, it is that kind of nonlinear thinking that you have to apply to something linear, which is what fiction writing is.
Yeah.
You know, you can't really write a resonant novel that just goes, well, and then this happened, and then that happened, and then this happened, because, I guess you can, but you have to be really lucky, because in the end, you had to have had kind of a direction that thematically made some sense. And maybe that muscle gets kept in shape during the football season by what I have to do for the football podcast, because I'm trying to think of it for sure as like a, I mean, I produce the show myself. It's me sitting in front of Audacity with an hour's worth of space to fill. What comes next and then next and then next and next. And again, if you're only just figuring that out, you're not relating it back to all the other shows you've done, all the vernacular that you've figured out, what you've thought in the past. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, for a show that claims to rage against narratives as much as I claim to rage against narratives, I sure do create a lot of narratives.
You spin a lot of webs. I do. That's so we talked beforehand when we were having lunch. We were talking about the idea of writing a novel and keeping this giant thing in your head, just kind of trying to keep track of something that's so big. But it's funny, as you describe this and the show, it feels like that too. There's a lot that you're, a lot of balls in the air. Do you find, I like to talk to our creative people about internally generated obstacles, you know, which fear, imposter syndrome, you know, like the negative voices that I know for me have always been sort of a part of the what's going on inside my head at all times. How do you deal with that, and how much is that a part of, you know, what your everyday creative life is like?
I try to be as much of a creature of habit as possible in the writing. And I think that's a big way to get away from, I mean, down to the point where if I have a good day, I got to go back to that same spot and drink the same thing, or listen to the same music. If I'm in like a public space.
What do you listen to? Just out of curiosity.
I mean, it's going to sound stupid, but today I listened to your record. To when I was writing this morning, I listened to
your
record.
You can listen to music with lyrics while you write. Okay.
Yeah. Not when I edit. When I edit, it has to be quiet. But when I'm writing, I actually can.
Yeah.
And prefer to. But present company accepted. But I really was, and I really do love the record. New Pornographers a lot.
Yeah.
Spoon a lot.
Yeah, I got that from Warren Sound.
Yeah. But so, and I'll if I have a New Pornographers day that's good, then damn, they're getting shuffled again, right? And I think part of it is to... I think of it as almost not being that healthy in some ways to try to create the exact same environment over and over again.
It's a level of compulsion.
It's a little OCD, and it's a little not accepting of life in some way. Life is change. And
do you think you're a control freak? This is the therapy part, by the way.
About some things definitely, and about other things so clearly not that like people who know me would go, oh no, not in this way and not in that way, but in the environment of writing or promptness and stuff like that. I think about some things, yes.
Yeah.
But like there are some things that I give so little thought to that people go, yeah, control. He's not in control.
It's funny. You talked about loneliness. Mm. You joke about loneliness. Mm. And I wonder if you think that's something that helps feed your art, or if that's something that you sort of have to grapple with to get through the days and keep making art.
I mean, both.
Yeah.
So much so, yeah. I mean, it's tough. I have been in lots of relationships, but never have been married.
Mm-hmm.
And feels like maybe that time is sort of slipping by, but I don't know. And I'm doing online dating now.
Yeah, that's the thing. I have so many friends that tell me.
Yeah, it's horrible. I've done it in the past, and I've met people that way, but I've sort of back on it again and hate it so much. And it makes me feel bad about myself, essentially. I mean, that's the problem. My interaction with the world is I have a mania to find things that make me feel bad about myself.
Oh.
It would be a lot easier to not write books. It would be a lot easier to not worry about acceptance of art. It would be a lot easier to just... I have like a kind of a great gig going on with this great audience that likes what I do. And hey, just do that, dude. You know, like do the thing that makes you feel good. And yet I have a compulsion toward... Yeah.
Well, what if no one ever did the thing that scared them or made them feel vulnerable? What kind of world would we live in? We wouldn't have the art. I'm glad you do it.
I mean, it's thank you. I mean, it's true, but that's why it's both fuel and impediment, right? Because we were talking about insomnia, right? And once I wake up, I'm up, man, and then the thoughts start running and all those thoughts, the 5 a.m. thoughts are almost never going to help you.
Yeah.
The 5 a.m. thoughts are always the one that are going, okay, well, so death is when, and therefore I have this much time until then. And, you know, it's funny, and yet it's totally, especially when you're, with the benefit of talking here in the early afternoon, it seems quite quaint. But I know you've been there. I listen to your music.
Yeah.
At 5 a.m., it's not fun.
Yeah.
And it is 100% like, well, yeah, it's... Those are the times where I go, let's see if we can make today exactly like it was yesterday when I wrote, because then that does feel like a little cage that, at least for as long as you're in it, you're in control. You get to decide what happens. I think it's why we like sports.
Mm-hmm.
It's why we like most of the things that we like. It's why we like fashion. It's why we like movies. It's all this kind of, we get to kind of siphon off this little world. And, feel like, okay, the chaos doesn't get in as much for these moments when I'm thinking about this stuff. What do you see? One of your lyrics, Moments of Transcendence, in this last.
Yeah. Thanks. The human condition.
Yeah.
It's funny, every night when I sing that, or whenever I sing that, I feel, because this speaks to what we're talking about, I feel like, oh, is this too much? Is this lyric too much? Is it too... I feel really vulnerable, like I'm like, because I'm walking, that lyric walks right up to the line of like, okay, am I being heavy-handed, you know, but it feels true.
I mean, we had a lovely conversation before we started, so I'm repeating to you, but the people didn't hear it. There's like three songs back to back to back on the new record that are wincingly true and painful, and I said to you, I don't really know how you do that without pushing me away. Those songs are pulling me in with painful truths that are so universal that they could be a cliche, mm-hmm. but you're just finding the right way to say it in a way that I need 300 pages to say. Right? And you're doing it in just a few lines of lyric poetry, and that's hard to do, man. That's really good.
Thank you. But I think that's something that comes through in your novels and even in the podcast. I think that you are willing to go there in a lot of ways. You're willing to be human. You're willing to show your, you know, foibles and your insecurities even. And I mean, I think that's great. How can you... Thanks. That's the only thing... That's what makes art, right? Yeah. All we're trying to do is grapple with what it means to be a human being.
It's true. I mean, I'm... So I did this podcast called The Juggernaut. Mm-hmm. I told you about that.
Yeah.
And we didn't know each other then, or I would have had you as a guest. Yeah. I would have been thrilled. We did probably 50 episodes or something. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it started me talking to some of the musicians that I talked to. Like, do you know Ross Flournoy from Apex Manor? He's in L.A. Great guy. I should introduce you guys. He's wonderful. I think he's on Merge.
Oh, cool.
Has a record coming out soon. Everybody should listen to Ross, yeah. Apex Manor. So I did the first several interviews of that show were me basically talking to musicians who had been nice to me when I was doing War on Sound. Mm-hmm. And then I have a producer, Dave Piper, who's still my producer, and he started looking for guests that I didn't know personally, just who had produced stuff that I thought was awesome. We wound up getting great guests. I mean, it wound up being really cool. Like, sort of ran its course, but during that run of engagement is when the Las Vegas shooting happened. Mm. And it happened the morning, or the night before the morning, I had to do an introduction for one of those podcasts, where I was introducing an interview that took place. We did the interview before the shooting. And I mean, I was crying doing the intro. Like, yeah. I'm almost crying now. Yeah. I had to stop. It was not usable. It was ridiculous, right? Because that doesn't help. So I just did it again. I tried it again. And I think I must have done it three different times. Yeah. And just tried to get through it. And never had as many... I mean, not that many people listen to that show, but I never had as many people write in and say, I'm so glad you left that in.
Yeah.
Whether I agree with you politically, whether I agree with, you know, like all the stuff that kind of stems from trauma, maybe we could disagree, but to hear somebody having a hard time getting through it made me feel more connected, and that's all you could ever want from any art.
Exactly. That's the whole reason we're here. So... this is how I wrap up each show, and I think you've given so much useful advice up to this point, but I'm going to ask you to distill it a little bit. If you were to meet a 20-year-old version of Chris Harris, but today, 20 years old in 2019,
right?
What advice would you give yourself?
Porn.
Get more of it or less of it?
Go in the industry. It seems like it's where everything's going. What would I say? I mean, here's the thing. I never really still to this day, have really fully 100% committed to fiction writing. Mm-hmm. I've always given myself an out. I wasn't an English major undergrad. I went and got an MBA. I went and got real jobs for a while. Then I kind of realized I was on the wrong path and probably needed that my 20s to grow up some and realize what was important, and yet got to the point where now I was doing football stuff, and now I was doing... So I don't know if I would say to my 20-year-old self, believe that you could do it. It's going to take a lot. You're not ready to do it now, even though you probably think you're a good enough writer to do it now, but no, really, probably not many people are at 20. But I didn't... I wish I had spent more time giving myself over to fiction writing. Not because I think that especially now, no one's going to be, being a literary fiction writer, not very many people make a living. So it's not so much a matter of finance, but I think I just would have written more.
Yeah.
And I probably would have understood myself better, and I probably just would have felt truer to myself in a way that now I feel truer to myself. I didn't really feel all that true to myself back then, doing business school stuff and then getting MBA-type jobs and waking up at 5 in the morning and working on a novel that wasn't very good. And I mean, I did it for years and years. Yeah. But if I'd been, I feel like that's the time, you know, early 20s, that would have been the time. And so I would probably give that advice.
So, I mean, I do, I think there's a certain level of bravery that characterizes all the stuff that you've done. But sort of what you're saying is own it early, be brave.
I mean, when else are you going to do it?
Yeah.
You know, when else other than when you're pretty darn young, is there really even time when you have the less responsibilities, when you don't have the financial overhead, you know? But then it begs the question, like, do I wish I'd been an English major? I read plenty. I wrote plenty. Do I wish I hadn't gone to business school? Some of my very best friends in the world that I've now known for 20-some years that I met, if I hadn't, you know, they're great. They're amazing. They're like some of my best readers, frankly.
Yeah.
So I don't regret the actual course that I took, but let's take it out of advice from me to sure. myself. I think somebody who loves it, music, painting, writing, whatever, if you're young, you know, it's easy for me to say, don't worry about money, because yeah. everyone needs to worry about money. And so much of this new book I'm writing about is about the gig economy.
Yeah.
You know, and how that becomes seductive and you're exhausted and you can't work and you don't have health insurance. And yet, all through that, yeah, I think be brave.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for being so generous and cool and fun. And I can't wait for next season, but I can't wait for your next book, more importantly.
Thank you very much for having me. It was fun.
Thanks, Chris. All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
This is Chris DeMakes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Chris DeMakes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Chris DeMakes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.